Welcome into You're the Cure right here on AM 580. Of course, Dr. Ben Edwards, Veritas Medical. Check out the website, veritasmedical.com, for archived programs. You can certainly do that, of course, right here on the program, along with Melody Wilkes, health coach.
Hello.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
We have a special guest in the studio. And
yes,
if you're going to want to, we're having some computer technological issues. I can still read text. The phone line still works, obviously. You can call in at 806-745-5800, call or text throughout the program. But just letting you know, it's a little bit more difficult today. It'll be fixed by next show for sure. But welcome back to the program, sir.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yes, absolutely.
We're excited to be here. Continue our talking about health and wellness and resiliency. That's my big word lately. Weston A. Price, in his book, I keep talking about the healthy folk who were eating traditional foods and the unhealthy folk were eating modern foods.
Right.
And so what he saw was this resiliency or resistance are two different words he used. So people that were resistant to disease, they were resistant to tuberculosis even. Chronic inflammatory disease, infectious disease, they just had a resiliency about them. And they weren't affected by these germs and weren't affected by diseases of inflammation. You know, I had a phone call last week, kind of sad phone call with a former patient from Post, and got to talking about cancer and young folks. And she just rattled off three or four different young people, like late teens, early 20s with cancer, stage 4 even,
wow,
cancers. And we've just lost our resiliency or our resistance. You know, of course, all the bugs going around, you hear about schools closing and
flu.
Got to close Friday and spray for germs and
mm-hmm.
these kind of things. We've lost a lot of this resiliency factor.
Yeah, Emma stayed home a whole week because I didn't take her in because I didn't know if she had flu or not.
Right.
Didn't get an official diagnosis, but now the school's like, well, we need a doctor's note. And I'm kind of like, oh, I didn't take her to the doctor.
Would a health coach note
work? I treated her myself.
Oh.
She got better. So I'm kind of like, not sure how I'm going to get out of that one. But
yeah. Well, and what Weston A. Price noted was mostly, he was focused on the food and the lack of traditional food, which was you lose minerals, you lose fat-soluble vitamins. Fat solubles were the biggest thing. He saw a tenfold decrease in fat-soluble vitamins when you eat modern foods. So, of course, we talk about food a lot, and this will be the subject of another future show, but I think the peace pillar, obviously, people are stressed. I just saw it was a poll of young people in America. The health thing that young people are concerned about the most, anxiety,
mm-hmm.
depression,
yeah.
mood-related
yeah.
stuff, and it's just constant 24/7 news cycle and fear mongering and just the world. I mean, we're obviously look around and the fear factor. So part of our loss of resiliency is the stress for sure.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. Probably even, I dare say, more than the food. But we can't ignore food, obviously.
But all that does, though, doesn't originate in the gut.
A lot of it does.
Because yeah. if you're not eating the appropriate things and you're not taking care of the gut gets out of whack, which jacks your hormones weird, then your hormones
yeah.
go crazy and then you end up having all these.
You're right. It's all related to the gut. And when we say gut, really, I think what we specifically what we're talking about is the microbes in the gut.
Right.
Because the food you eat is either going to encourage that microbe life to flourish and diversify and be robust, or the food that you put in your mouth is going to kill the microbial life in your gut. And it's the microbes in the gut that not only digest your food, these microbes secrete enzymes that break your food down. Human beings can make a handful of enzymes. These microbes make thousands and thousands of enzymes to break your food down. The microbes make the vitamins, some of them, like B vitamins, B12, vitamin K, vitamin C. So they're actually making nutrients for you. So they're breaking down nutrients so you can absorb them. They're making nutrients. And then they're also making the neurotransmitters, the serotonin, melatonin, the dopamine. These are the brain chemistry molecules that keep your mood steady. But then they also interact with your immune system. So the chronic inflammation that we see is because of a jacked up immune system, an immune system that's not responding appropriately, either underactive or overactive. That's autoimmune.
I have a friend that came up to me at church, and she has mast cell disorder.
Yeah. So the mast cells hold your histamine. They hold other things too, but mostly histamine. Histamine is a chemical of one of the weapons of mass destruction, we call it. The immune system has all these different chemical weapons at its disposal to use to kill these bugs when it needs to. And histamine is one of them, but the mast cells can get destabilized and they can just dump all their histamine all at once. And so you get this massive histamine release and therefore tons of symptoms. So histamine symptoms are like hives, itchy eyes, sneezing.
She said all she could eat was brown rice and potatoes.
Yeah. So mast cell destabilization. And there's drugs you can take like Singulair, and there's others that stabilize your mast cells. There's some herbs that'll stabilize the mast cell. But why is that mast cell need stabilizing? Why is it not? It should be naturally stable.
Yeah.
And so that's where these microbes in the gut, they talk to our immune system cells. Like your mast cell, like your T cells, like your B cells. So there's a communication going on between your gut microbes and your immune system. It's fascinating. Well, and the immune system's your backbone for everything, to kill the germs, this cancer epidemic we're seeing. I mean, that's a dysfunctional immune system. Autoimmune. I mean, autoimmune's off the chart. That's a dysfunctional immune system. So it all comes back to the gut. It comes back to nutrition. It comes back to feeding the good microbes in your gut. And that's why I love talking about the agricultural stuff so much, because there's such a relationship there. Mm-hmm. We talked to Gabe Brown a few weeks ago, who wrote the book Dirt to Soil, and it was all about get the microbes back in the soil. Yeah. It's the same thing we're preaching at Veritas on humans. The human side is get the microbes back in the gut, get the diversity back in the gut. But it's so related to what you're eating. And when you eat foods that are chemical-laden in particular, Roundup in particular, glyphosate. I just had a phone call this weekend with a doctor. This glyphosate thing is just, the research that's coming out, it's awful. I mean, it's absolutely mind-boggling awful the way this glyphosate not only chelates the minerals so that the minerals aren't available for us, but it kills the microbial life, not only in the soil. And therefore, the microbes in the soil can't nourish the plant, and the plant can't make nourishing foods for us. But the glyphosate gets into our gut, and it kills our gut bacteria. I mean, it's just...
When do you think Congress is going to change this?
Forget about that.
When the anti-glyphosate people have more money than the pro-glyphosate people, money rules
There's
the whole thing.
No
I hate to say it, but that's the way it is. I mean, who can buy the most advertising? Who can... pay the lobbyists the most.
Well, I think what ends up happening in those situations, and we've got a special guest here.
Yeah,
on
we
got to
get to Rich.
Yeah, Rich.
We go off on politics.
But I mean, he understands as a local producer, as a farmer who wants to get, because see, there would be a market for that, and I think that market is growing.
It is,
and so as more people become aware and educated about these things, then they are going to seek out producers such as what we're going to talk about today.
Exactly.
And they're going to start saying, you know what, if food is my medicine, I'm not going to put something junk in, junk out, and risk. Not saying it's guaranteed that you're going to get cancer, but I don't want to take that additional risk. I want to eat clean, and I want to eat healthy. And I want to go support that guy, that producer, or that company, that industry, whatever, that is putting out good quality stuff that lessens that risk.
Lessens the risk and by building your resiliency
Absolutely.
Factor. This is all about build that resiliency. So, Rich Smith with Dirt Rich Farms is with us in studio today. And that's exactly why Rich is here. Not only because he has a passion to educate and renew the mind just like I do on these topics, but also to let people know he's here, he's knowledgeable, he's experienced, and he's available to do consulting. He's available to help move this whole movement forward. And even in the getting the food to your mouth more conveniently through a food truck. We'll hopefully get to that at the very end of the show. But there's lots of opportunities locally, and we just need to encourage and support these kind of folks. But it all starts with education. If you don't know the why behind it, and I tell patients this every single day in my clinic, you got to know the why behind everything I'm going to advise you to do. Otherwise, you're not going to stick with it. And don't do anything any doctor would tell you to do without knowing the why behind it. And it's going to be the same with your food. Why are you going to go buy organic, or why are you going to go buy from a local farmer, and why are you going to never eat a strawberry that's not organic? And, you know the why behind it. So that's why Rich is here, to help open our minds and renew our minds and educate us and motivate us, so we can all build our resiliency factor. So, Rich, thank you for joining us in studio today. And we've taken up a lot of your time, but I'm sure we'll make up for it. We whetted people's appetites. Well, I'm going to give the floor to you mostly to introduce yourself and explain to people where you came from, how you got to where you are now, your background a little bit, and kind of what you do now, kind of what your vision is and what drives you and why are you doing what you're doing kind of thing. So,
great.
You got the floor to introduce yourself to our listeners. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Ben. I grew up on a dry land farm in Lamesa. Our farms were in Lamesa and in O'Donnell, cotton. And we were kind of one of those unique families that did cotton, but we also had a little side business, the chicken business. Mm-hmm. And but we were full force into industrial agriculture. We had the dryland farming end of it with cotton, and we had the industrial chicken model where we would raise 40,000 chicks up into layer pullets over about a 16-week period, and then ship them back out to the next person who would be the laying end of that arm. And so I grew up in a family that, frankly, you know, I thought my picture of farming was a lot of what a lot of people around here, their picture of farming was. And for that very reason, I didn't want anything to do with it. You know, I grew up thinking that farming was just this dusty, hard work that you plant the seed, you try to tend to that plant, and you're pumping in what it needs, and you're trying to get the growth out of it, and then you're harvesting it, and you're leaving that field bare, you know, for 6 months, and during that time, the wind's going to blow, and we're just going to live with those dirt storms, you know. And frankly, I didn't want anything to do with it. And farming was my granddad's way of life. It was my dad's way of life, but it wasn't going to be my way of life. So I went a completely different direction, and I decided to become a musician and minister.
Those crazy musicians.
That's right. And anyway, so yeah, went that route, and still do that. But about 15 years ago, began to I was traveling to do some work, some ministry work, pretty often on planes, and would look for a magazine to, you know, spend my time while I was waiting for my next flight, and came across, you know, some magazines like Mother Earth News and things like that. They're kind of what I would call the hippie ag stuff. And I thought, well, this will still be entertaining, you know, mildly entertaining, and way to pass the time for a little bit. But what I didn't realize is that it was kind of like my rabbit hole. And so that was my gateway drug, if you will. And so moved from that into some other magazines, Acres Magazine, which is more about production, you know, less homesteading and more production, farm production, from a regenerative mindset. And from there began to recognize some of the names that kept popping up there, and moved on into their books. And then I'm one of those guys that, you know, when I see somebody, I think, well, that's an actual person, and I could probably meet them and talk to them and learn from them. And so I would follow up some of those authors and attend conferences and their lectures, and meet them and go to their farms and learn from them, and just basically received kind of an unofficial, you know, like so many things, you know, like holistic medicine, you know. Mm-hmm. You really kind of have to learn that off of the beaten path. In the same way with regenerative agriculture, it's just not available at a tier one school.
No,
at
it's
this
not.
Point.
Well, do you think it ever will be?
Probably not, for the aforementioned reason of, you know, the funding in these tier one schools in agriculture comes from places that really have a vested interest.
You don't
in
think
things
it'll ever be
same.
As a maybe like an elective I could take, and as you know, we have a great ag department at Texas Tech University, and we have the last ag show actually in all of Lubbock Media right here on AM 580. We talk ag every day at lunch with Jim Stewart, but and we bring some of the professors out from Tech. And I just don't know why that there wouldn't, at the very bare minimum, be an elective.
I'm hopeful.
Something like that.
I'm hopeful. The issue is money. You know, it's, you know, when you have Bear Crop Science, well, I shouldn't name names. But
no, that's fine. You know, they're a sponsor here. I don't mind. Maybe not after today's show. I'm just kidding.
When you have certain large industry leaders who are driven by a mindset that says that it's all about the plant, and we stimulate the plant, or we stimulate the animal, we're focusing, instead of on a system, we're focusing on a product, just a singular product, and we're isolating that product. I don't believe that it's altogether sinister, the mindset on it, but I do believe there's a belief construct there, and their belief construct supports that mindset. So that's what gets proliferated in our tier one institutions, is that mindset that goes really from a background that was the seeds of which were planted probably back in the 60s, maybe even a little bit earlier. Notions like, you know, go big or go home, from our Secretary of Agriculture back in the 60s, who had a mindset that said, basically, if you're not a big farmer, you're not gonna be able to make it in the coming years.
That's true. Corporate farming has taken over.
Mindsets like farmers can't make it apart from subsidies. You know, these are things that mindsets like farmers don't need to worry about marketing. Farmers don't need to have relationship to sell their products within a local system.
Sure.
It takes the farmer and it puts them into it isolates them, pulls them out of the social structure, the social fabric of the community. But it also puts several middlemen between the farmer and the end user. And because of that, we've impoverished our farmers, and we've created, in effect, one of the largest subsidized systems in our country. And we've got people that don't believe that it can be any other way. So along with that, you were asking about the agricultural arm of that. That's a whole way of thinking.
Yeah. It's a system.
It's a system.
It's same as medicine. It is.
Right.
I mean, is Texas Tech Medical School going to start teaching more of a holistic integrative?
Oh, yeah. Functional medicine.
They may have a tiny little elective thing or a lunchtime lecture here and there, you know, dip their toe in it. But it's a system, a total different mindset change. And,
you just don't see that happening.
I don't see it happening. I see another system developing alongside it. And it's going to be the people driving it. The demand is going to come from the grassroots, because in medicine, the results are so awful. I mean, we have the worst health outcomes anywhere, and we're spending the most money and going bankrupt doing it. So just purely the economics and the results are going to force the end user to start looking somewhere else.
Even
if the tier ones aren't going to get on board at the beginning, the end user is going to force it.
But that's my point back to production ag. I think the same thing could happen. Now, let's be honest. I don't think that what we're talking about here, either on production agricultural basis or even in a holistic medicine situation, will ever completely take over the system.
Right.
I just don't see that ever in a million years. Not in our lifetimes.
Sure.
I just don't see it.
Perhaps not. But Wade, one of the interesting things about it is nature wins.
Yeah.
And so right now, you know, we're running out of water at an alarming pace. We're calling, you know, farmers farm according to soil types. We call them soil types, but really throughout the plains, people that are farming, and more land is being taken out of grass and put into farming, intensive agriculture for monocropping, mainly corn and things like that, because of the subsidies that are available for them. But this approach to agriculture is basically it's creating something that's not sustainable. And when something's not sustainable, I say nature will win. It's to say, if we run out of water, we won't be able to pursue the way of farming that we've been pursuing the last several decades, which is completely reliant on irrigation. We won't be able to continue. If we lose subsidies, we won't be able to continue to farm the way we've been farming.
Well, let me push back on that a little bit. What if, and again, there's a lot of research being done currently with the Russian milk thistle. And you know how drought tolerant that is. That's the old proverbial tumbleweed. We see them all over the place, especially on Saturday with 60-mile-an-hour winds. But if Bayer Crop could come out and say, we have absolutely cloned this plant, and we have been able to genetically alter this cotton stock, and you know what? You can grow that on 1 inch of water. It can be grown in the desert. And you know, there's a lot of things from a high-tech standpoint that I think that will come into play at some point. But to your point, I mean, again, and I know we're talking cotton, and I don't have a problem with that because we're not digesting cotton.
Right.
We're talking about where my concerns lie.
It's a lot of cotton seed oil, though.
It's the, digest, the consumption of foods into your bodies, a way different animal.
Let me say real quick.
Okay.
First, the high-tech, because in medicine, I mean, you can't get more high-tech than what's the latest drug coming out of Hopkins or Harvard or Mayo or wherever. How many of these high-tech advancements have we seen over the years, even decades? And I always go back to the most high-tech, amazingly engineered and designed way of doing things is nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they can figure out how to make that tumbleweed gene go into the cotton plant to make it drought resistant, that'll be great for a time period. But then some unintended consequence will happen. Mm-hmm. Some other piece of the pie gets affected in some other negative aspect, and I'm not smart enough to predict what that'll be, or probably nobody is. And that's the problem with our high-tech way of doing things. It isn't lined up with the natural symbiosis. Is there some I didn't think about that. Just like when Roundup first came out, this will be great. It'll kill all this stuff. Oh, I didn't think about X, Y, and Z. That's the problem with man's high-tech way of doing things. And I'm not totally anti-technology. I mean, maybe I am. But I'm just saying that would be my prediction is there's going to be some unintended consequence
because of genetic
altering. The next high-tech thing. It'll fix that one problem temporarily, and it'll induce 10 others. And just like with Gabe Brown a few weeks ago, when you get that soil right and all of a sudden the symbiosis comes back and the fungi and the microbes and this and that, the whole thing fixes itself. It even carbon sequesters all the carbon made since the Industrial Revolution gets sequestered into the earth. Naturally, if you put the grasses back like
I agree with that, but then you run headlong into what? Costs. The cost of it, you know, if you have a big production farmer out here who's tilling up the land and there's, you know, a couple of years we don't grow cotton on this 4,000 acres, then we're going to shift over to, you know, X crop for rotation purposes, what have you. The cost is what some producers may say, well, wait a minute, Rich, this is a little rough on the cost aspect.
Sure.
I agree with you
sure.
in theory, but in theory, I got to write the check.
Right. Well, and back to Ben's point for a moment, that those are the unintended side effects. If you're medicine, you know, you watch these commercials all the time, and they talk about these new wonder drugs, and at the very end, the guy goes into hyperspeed
about
the list of all the things that could potentially come from that. Well, there is a list of all things that potentially come from that when we try to say, I want to take something that's been naturally created, and I want to basically control it. I want to make it do what I want it to do. What we embrace in regenerative agriculture is biomimicry, which is basically to look at nature and say, how was this created? How is it designed to work? And it's always in systems. It's never isolated. Man wants to isolate things. We want to play with things in our mind and put things out here in a bubble and think that we can mess with the inside of it and not affect anything else on the outside. But there's always all these unintended side effects of it. And so, for instance, one of the side effects of constant plowing, every time we rip that ground open, we release the carbon into the atmosphere. The ground needs that carbon. That's simple sugars to feed the microbes, and when those microbes receive the simple sugars from the plants, they're going to break down the minerals, and they're going to provide those minerals back into the plants. And guess what? If we're eating those plants, we get remineralized through those plants as well without having to take a pill. But it's all these unintended consequences of, well, I want to plant this one crop. Well, how does nature do it? Do you ever see an area in nature where there's just one thing growing? Just one.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. There's, now, it may look like, well, yes, this is just a pine forest here. oh no, look closer, my friend. You know, you've got to get down on the floor of the forest and see that there's all sorts of other life going on underneath that. Nature abhors monoculture. It also abhors a vacuum. And yet, we leave our fields bare throughout the year. Nature says, hey, no, we're going to find some way to keep a living root in the soil 365 days of the year, so that those simple sugars that are being pumped into the ground from that plant photosynthesizing, you know, we talk about a lot of times in we call ourselves grass farmers, even though what we're really producing is, you know, our end product is something off a herbivore, you know, like beef,
right.
or lamb. But we call ourselves grass farmers, and even some folk call themselves sunshine farmers, you know, because what our goal is to create as many solar collectors as we can, which is, i.e., grazable plants,
mm-hmm.
all with different sizes and shapes of collection that face all different ways, some of them flat and broad, some of them long and tall, so that wherever the sun is during the day, we're collecting carbon out of the atmosphere, by the way.
Oh, that should be great for the Green New Deal.
Yeah,
they indeed. Should love that.
Seriously, they should.
Subsidize you.
Well, you know, if you're subsidizing something regenerative,
right,
that can continue to perpetuate, well, it's different than subsidizing something that requires it annually. Mm. And I'm not completely against all forms of subsidy. I'm against subsidy that requires annualization. Mm-hmm. You know, if we have to keep coming back in order to keep, that's not good business. I mean, if you're running any other business,
subsidize a degenerative process, something that's going to degrade the land, degrade the water, degrade the resources, as opposed to regenerate.
Right. What we call farming now, our monocropping farming, is actually more akin to mining. And so we keep taking out of the soil, and yet we come to believe that somehow this is normal. This is the way we've always done it. Well, I'm sorry, that's just not true. This is the way we've done it since 1875.
Mm-hmm.
But what can we biomimic from before 1875 that was working, interestingly, without our help? And now what can we do if we actually come alongside and say, we're going to use our powers of observation to recognize that I can bring some, I can agree with nature, I can agree with the Creator and the way He's designed things, and see even more increase come to that.
Yeah. Let's talk about that after the break. We're up against it. When we come back, we'll go back to the 1890s. And what did things look like around here? What was nature growing and doing, and how did life look on the plains? And when we get back, we'll talk about that.
Welcome back into You're the Cure right here on AM 580. Always fun to talk.
If
the break is always
the best. During the break, that's when the good stuff happens.
Oh my goodness, that was great. Okay, so anyway, we're back at it, and again, Rich Smith here on the program with us. We're talking about production agriculture from a standpoint of a holistic way of doing things.
Yep.
Interesting stuff.
And we could spend a good hour or 5 hours talking about production ag versus regenerative and politics and this money and blah, blah, blah. But I want to get into where Gabe Brown, Dirt to Soil author, he really talked a lot on our show about farming, basically, and how to crop rotate and cover crops and all these kind of things. But I want to move more into the ranching side of things and animal production because of what, before the break, we were talking about in the 1800s. How were things, how did it used to be around here, and what did the land used to look like, and how did nature, naturally seed this land, and what was growing here, and blah, blah, blah. So, Rich, let's go that direction. You were talking about in the 1800s and the plains and the grasses and being a grass farmer. Bring all that around and into animal production.
Gladly. So there was from 1875 back, there was a great swath of grass that ran all the way from south of here all the way up through southern Canada and the area we call now the Great Plains. And in that area, the keystone species was the bison. And these bison, they numbered some 60 million strong, if you can imagine. And along with the bison, we had huge herds of antelope and deer, even elk in this region. They weren't just a mountainous species back then. And these, especially the bison, and again, this was the pre-fence era, you know.
Sure.
And so because of that, these bison were allowed to freely roam. But when you think of a herd of bison now, or maybe perhaps you've gone to Yellowstone or somewhere else to see them. By the way, that'd be outside their natural habitat. They were seeded into that area, but they're a plains species, and they were the tender of the plains, if you will. And the way the bison would operate, now we see them in there, and you might see a bison here, bison there, you know. But the bison would be mobbed up. Really super close to each other for one reason. It's predation. There were cats out here at that point, lots of mountain lions, bear. We had bear out here, wolves, not just coyotes. All of these predators would feed mainly on these. I mean, they feed on the herbivores, you know. So the ones they get, though, are not the big, strong ones. They pick off the young and the old. And the way for the young and the old to be safe is in numbers. So because of that, they would be bunched together as they would graze. Well, when they're grazing, they're not wanting to eat where they've fouled the soil, where they've either trampled it or manured it. And so what that would mean is a couple of things. They would compete for the grasses, which means they wouldn't just selectively take a bite here, take a bite there. When they came to an area of fresh pasture, heads down, get after it.
Like a big lawnmower.
Indeed it was, exactly. Yeah. Like that. And when we're looking at biomimicry, we call that a pulse. Because in the area that they left behind, it's like it almost looks like devastation, right? Because they've trampled things up, it's dunged, manured, wallowed in. But the truth is, they wouldn't stay there. They would move on. And they'd start, let's just say they'd start in a season down here in the south, and they'd begin to move up northward. And as they moved, they'd leave that pulse behind them, not to return to it again until it began to get cold in the north, and they'd begin to migrate back down. Well, this pulsing effect is something we can learn from.
Talk about how wide and, I mean, how big was this mob?
Yeah. We talked about that before, haven't we? So, there, men like Charles Goodnight, they were kind of the historians of that age, when they were settling this back in the late 1800s. He would talk about waking up in the midst of what he thought was the worst thunderstorm that he'd ever heard, and he ran out of his tent to see what was going on and found himself in the middle of a bison stampede. And they weren't really stamping; they were just moving through the area. He said it took that bison, that one herd of bison, a full 2 days to pass them. And back then, single herds could be as big as 50 miles square. So you're talking about an immense number of animals here, all tightly packed together, impacting an area, but they would leave. And what they would leave in their wake would be disturbed soil, which you'd think, well, that's not good, right? Well, no, some of that's trampled down, so it creates a grass mat to protect the soil still. Some of those seeds have been knocked off that get back underneath that to regenerate the next growth rate of the plant. But they've also provided the manures for the nutrition of the soil, so those microbes can eat and produce the environment that those seeds need to flourish and create new plants. And for whatever plants that happen to have just been eaten off, to just go grow right back up. So when they would come back into that, they would have fresh pasture to eat again when they return back to it several months later. What's interesting about that is what we call, I hit on this just a little bit ago, what we call soil types now in American agriculture are actually subsoils. We're talking, you can grow depending on what your soil is. Is it sandy? Is it sandy loam? Is it clay? Well, all of that's subsoil. because soil is pretty much the same anywhere you find it. And what's interesting is soil, the reason they call it subsoil is because it's underneath the topsoil. And topsoil is built on top of subsoil. It's not just where you come in and you mix you know some manure with your subsoil and call that soil. No, we had at that time soils that were two and a half feet deep and black earth. This is in this region now. We don't see that anymore.
We've got caliche out at our house.
Right, that's subsoil, and that's where the mineral content is. It's necessary. You know, in the microbial life can nourish the plant with that and turn and bring that mineralization up into the plant so that when it's eaten, it either goes into the meat that we eat or the vegetables that we eat or the fruit that we eat. But it's not, you know, that's the way it's intended to work. It's not supposed to grow on that medium. It's supposed to grow on the medium that's above that. That's one of the essences of biomimicry that we look at now is how can we approximate that? Well, you know, bison are pretty hard to control. So we're going to take an animal that's like a bison but more domesticated, the cow. And we're going to approximate without predation that compacted area, you know, and we're going to use electric fencing to do that. We're going to tighten them up instead of having a free graze, which is what most ranchers do. Where these animals they go out and they selectively graze, and they eat like little kids. If little kids are left to their own devices, they're going to eat their candy first, right? Mm-hmm. So they're going to find the most palatable species, and they're going to eat that first. And then when they've eaten that up, what do? They go back to try to find it again, and so that maybe it's grown just an inch more once they get back around to it, and they take that second bite. Well, that second bite, the first bite gives that plant an opportunity to grow up. It exposes the root base, which is where the grasses grow from, right at the base of the ground. But that second bite begins to wound the plant. And if they come back to it for a third time, they can kill it. Well, so then that species is gone out of the field. Then they go to the next most palatable species. So you see these ranchers that have said, man, we just don't have any, you know, we've got to put, you know, cubes out for the cattle. We got to throw out hay. We got, you know, because there's not enough nutrition out there for them. Well, what we're finding is if we can mimic what the bison did by utilizing tighter grazing patterns, taking a group of cattle and bringing them in close together, and then the next day moving them off of that spot, giving it a chance to rest, then when we come back to it, the soil profile deepens. We have more vegetation for those cattle to be able to eat the next time around too, and we can do this on fewer acres.
So instead of putting 25 head on a section or something like that, you can put 25 head on a half acre.
Right, for a day.
Right.
Perhaps
move them, and they don't come back to that half acre right. For 6 months or 12 months or something.
But you're always using your powers of observation. We want to set it and forget it kind of approach to agriculture. You know, and that's where that control thing comes back in. With this, man is necessary. We're necessary in the process because just like in the beginning, depending on the way you come to things, right? God places Adam on the earth and he says, hey, I want you to rule over it. Basically, Adam's saying, God's saying, I want to unlock to you what the purpose of all these animals are. What are they happiest doing? How do they work? And I'm convinced that part of the curse for Adam was forgetting the jobs that these animals could do and remain happy. You know, mm-hmm. They're all happiest if they're doing what they're created to do.
Yep.
Well, cattle are created to mow the lawn, you know. And they're happiest when we do that. Well, so what have we done? Well, we want to increase production, so we'll stick them in a feed yard and put grain in them, which, by the way, is part of the methane problem with cows. They don't produce as much methane when they're on grass.
Part of the subsidy issue, having to produce all this grain to feed cows and other livestock.
When they're not even intended to eat it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or put it in our gas tank.
Yeah. And you put something different in the gas tank, and what you get out is gas.
Right.
Yeah. That's back to the cow fart thing.
There you go.
We could actually limit that a lot just by going back the way it was that God intended.
Sure.
The nature side of things. Mm-hmm. You could reduce that.
Well, and that builds soil.
It does,
know? Yeah.
You reduce that output because they're not eating the grain, but then that grass, when you're regenerating all these grasses, because then different species of grasses start to grow, and the right. coverage gets better, and the thickness and growth rates are better, and when that grass grows, it's pushing carbon back into the soil.
Right.
It's a beautiful
system. Yeah.
The original intent, God's original intent, that system's always going to be better, and the results are going to be better. But birds, we've got a few minutes left.
Sure.
There's always birds with those bison, or in Africa, you see the buffalo and the elephant herds, and you always see those white birds or some kind of bird. So you bring in the chickens, right?
Yeah, sure. So that's another aspect of biomimicry, just like you said, Ben. We look at nature and we say, well, how does nature do it? And then we approximate that with the tools that we have at our disposal. Again, the goal of this is, just like people, we're all created to work, and we're happiest when we're doing something that we're made to do, our designed intent.
Yeah.
So what's the designed intent of the bird in the relationship between birds and herbivores? Well, they break the pest cycle. The birds break the pest cycle for the herbivores, especially parasites. And the herbivores provide protection for the birds, generally speaking, and also dung, manure that provides a protein source for them as they pick through it and find those insects and things like that tend to come into it. So what happens in our system is we move cows through first. And the cows mow it down. They mow down a portion of the pasture. Then we bring chickens in behind them like a layer flock. And those chickens are free range. They're not in a building. They're given access to that space that the cows were in. And even if you don't fence the chickens in, which sometimes you need to do for predation's sake, but even if you don't fence them in, they're going to stay tied in. Why? Well, because they want that manure. They want to pick through that manure. And what's amazing about that is if you time it right... Again, that's where man comes in, agreeing with the way God created things to work. We're bringing this other species through there at the right time to pick out those fly larvae, which are one of the big problems with cattle. That's why we spray them in conventional ag approach. You know, you got to spray cattle. You don't have to. If you follow up with chickens, they break through that manure, spread it. No mechanical spreading necessary. They spread the manure, eat the fly larvae out. You don't have as much of a horn fly problem or a house fly problem at that point because they've eaten out the larvae. They get a feed benefit out of that, requires less of a feed ration, and they're happier. They lay more eggs.
More nutritious eggs, too.
More nutritious eggs, and that manure is able to go back into the soil to feed the microbes, which in turn break down... the mineral life and make it bioavailable to the plants, creating more nutritious plants for the animals to graze on in the next cycle.
Pretty amazing.
It is.
It's almost like you could have had the smartest engineers at the Tier 1 university try to come up with the perfect system.
Right.
And bingo, we found it.
Well, let me ask Rich this. I know we are running short on time, but how much land that you just described perfectly how this works, how much land out here in the sound of my voice, we cover about 120 miles in a circle, how much land do you think is actually being utilized in that way right now?
A minuscule fraction. But there are some early adopters.
Would it be 2,000, 3,000 acres? I mean, we got millions of acres of...
I have a friend that's listening today that's a rancher down just off the Cap Rock. He has 3.5 sections.
Okay.
And he's approaching this with that.
Well, that's good. Good to know.
He's doing cattle and goats. He doesn't have chickens in that yet, although he's kind of been after me to try to help him implement chickens into his model. It just requires a little bit more management if you have chickens on site.
Yeah, well, you got the coyote problem. There's a lot of things that jump into that.
But the beautiful thing about it, Wade, is that so the entry point to agriculture, we one of the lies that we believed, I'll just go through some quick lies, right? One of the lies we believe is that dirt always blows in West Texas. That is a lie. Dirt has not always blown in West Texas. Dirt didn't start blowing really massively until the Dust Bowl, the 30s.
Yeah, I agree.
So what can we do, a cause and effect on that? The ground was uncovered. Yeah, that's when all this land is being broken out.
Well, we knew even from the Dust Bowl era that if we came back in and planted some things, in fact, the federal government said you must do this. And you know when that decision came was when West Texas ended up in Washington, D.C.
Right.
And these politicians in Congress are sitting there one day and they looked out the window, true story, back in the 30s. And they said, what is all this black stuff? And they said, that's from the Midwest. And they go, what are they doing out there? It was federal policy then that immediately came down. They were getting dust in D.C. and said, hey, you know what? You guys out there have got to do something different with the soil. It came to D.C.
Right. Well, and that's... The big lie there is that dirt will always blow. The truth is the wind has always blown out here.
Sure.
But when we had grasses, predominant species in this area, multi-species grasses and not monocrops.
Sure.
Which monocrops are always going to have a season of fallow. And unless you're wanting to plant on your own dime that cover crop after that and implement. Now, some farmers are doing that. They're beginning to plant cover crops and then introducing even the herbivores to graze that during that season. That's kind of a good way to handle that.
That's good.
If you want to continue to monocrop, you know, follow it with a grazable, not just wheat, mind you, but a multi-species cool season mix of grasses because they have a symbiotic relationship with each other.
Excellent.
And then bring the herbivores behind that to graze it. You're increasing microbial life. I believe Jeremy Brown. I know he does it with the cover crops. I'd like to talk to Jeremy about introducing the herbivores along with that, because then when you bring in the animal systems, when you separate out animals from plants, nature never does that.
Yeah, right.
So you know it's one thing to do that in a market garden size area, but if you're doing that over great swaths of ground, you're really isolating some things that were never meant to be isolated.
Sure. But in that part of lie number two is you have to have thousands and thousands of acres to be profitable.
Yes.
I mean, in the current system, yeah, but in your system or the God's original intent system, I'd say, can you get by on 100 acres, 200 acres, 50 acres?
Depending on what you want to on what you want to raise, you can get by. I mean, there are market gardeners now that are getting by on a full-time income on less than an acre. Now, that's intensive production of vegetables, right?
Yep.
You say, well, isn't that kind of the same thing as what you're saying is bad? Well, it's not awesome, but they're actually putting back into the soil in order to continue to get healthy vegetables out of it. But it's on a small scale. They're not trying to monocrop that. They've got lots of different vegetables. But you can do it on 1 acre. You can do the egg layer operation I was talking about on as few as 20 acres. You know, you can do sheep on as few as 50 acres, a full system that will provide a full-time income. You can do cattle on as few as 100 acres. You know, there are, and especially if you begin to stack these systems, where you have multiple incomes coming off of one piece of ground, because you're doing cattle, sheep, chickens, perhaps all in the same area. You've got a way to be able to really have a nice income for your family, and you're regenerating the soil. It's going to get better and better every year.
Yeah.
So the big lie on that is, yeah, go big or go home. I say no.
Yeah.
You know, it's you don't have to be born either with a silver spoon in your mouth or having inherited land in order to be able to be a farmer or a rancher.
Yeah. I know that's a lifestyle that a lot of people around here appreciate, and they want their kids and grandkids to be able to pursue that. And so many people are actually are forced out of farming today because that system is just not sustainable, and financially it's not doable for them. And it's unfortunate and it's sad that those kids who were born and given the gifts by God to the reason they were created was to be a farmer, basically. They love it. It's in their heart. But they can't because of the way the finances in that current system. So this gives hope to them that there is a different way to do things. We might have to have you back to talk about all that because I think that's a whole other show
of
the finance part of it. Or maybe you can be on Jim Stewart's show and talk about the finance part of it. But, you know, we've covered a lot of ground. Thank you. Lots of good topics to debate and talk about. But if this resonates with someone and they think, this is right on. I want to do it. How can they get in touch with you? Or are you available to talk more details of how do I actually implement some of this into my farm?
Indeed. Yeah. You're welcome. If you're looking for some consultation toward that end, I'd be glad to visit with you about it. You can email me at richsmith70@gmail.com. That's probably the best way to get a hold of me for that.
Rich. Is that written out 70 or is it
R-I-C-H-S-M-I-T-H 70 at gmail.com.
And we didn't get to it, but Farm to Table, Farm to Fork, I'm sorry, Farm to Fork food truck. I know, and catering, they're doing a great job for some local businesses in town, doing some lunches, and they're available for weekends and big events, weddings or whatever, any opportunities like that. So I know Rich is getting involved in that, so you could email him also there,
to get
a hold of you if you wanted
to talk with you about that.
Some good food at a decent price, but remember, you want to pay a little more for your food so you pay less for medicine down the road. So
amen.
Don't be scared to pay a little more for organic or
yeah.
for quality
no doubt,
food.
Right?
I'm not saying Rich's food truck is expensive. It's a great opportunity to get real food, nutrient-dense food at a great price, too. Mm-hmm. So, Rich, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
It's been great. We covered lots of good ground. I think we encouraged people today. So, appreciate you. We'll have to have you back someday.
All right. Of course, you've been listening to You're the Cure right here on AM 580. Dr. Ben Edwards, of course, and don't forget tomorrow's show.
Tomorrow, on a much smaller scale, we have Denise Dietz out. It's going to talk
Denise.
About organic gardening. So
awesome. Denise is an awesome gardener.
On
we
a
love
much
Denise.
Smaller scale
yeah.
at home.
And I hear Wolf Earth Farmers Markets year-round now. I just heard that last week. We'll have to get them on the show, too, or on your show.
Yeah.
Be great. All right.
So that's tomorrow, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, right here on AM 580. All right. Hey, that's Melody Wilkes, Debbie Hernandez, here on AM 580. And, of course, Dr. Ben Edwards, Veritas Medical. Check out the website, veritasmedical.com. And thanks, everybody. Look forward to it. We'll see you back here next time around.